Real people. Real opinions. Real talk radio. The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Show. Classic hits.
Now, one man, by the way, who has caused quite a bit of a stir on the internet at the moment. He has his own YouTube channel known as the Fat Emperor. Ivor Cummins, who completed a biochemical engineering degree in 1990. He has spent 30 years in corporate technical leadership positions. His career speciality has been leading large worldwide teams in complex problem-solving activity. And since 2012, Ivor has been intensively researching the root causes of modern chronic disease. A particular focus has been on cardiovascular disease, diabetes and obesity. He shares his research, insights at public speaking engagements around the world, revealing the key nutritional and lifestyle interventions which will deliver excellent health and personal productivity. More recently, of course, he has been looking at the figures in relation to COVID-19 and sharing his views both on his own YouTube channel, The Fat Emperor, and also on Twitter and other social medias as well as giving talks about it. And he joins me on the air tonight. Ivor Cummins, good afternoon to you, or good evening to you, sorry.
Great to be here, Niall.
Yeah, well, Ivor, it's not a good day, is it, really, to be, I suppose, having a pop at the government and their strategy when we have announced tonight 442 new cases, quite a high number, and 4 deaths. Now, I don't know if any of those deaths are historical, that hasn't been mentioned, but we could take it that those 4 deaths happened, obviously, in the last 24 hours, if it hasn't been mentioned that they're historical. This puts a lot of fear into people when we see case numbers going up and deaths going slightly up. Also, we're seeing ICU levels up into double digits. We're also seeing, I suppose, you know, hospitalizations up over 115. And people go, well, oh, this is getting serious again.
Yeah, and that's understandable. But we've got to remember we're moving into the autumn now, and it's an inevitability. We're going to have respiratory distress. And, you know, as we head into the winter, we're going to have more of it. And this is something that has occurred for kind of forever. So I think the key measure will be the mortality above or excess mortality in the coming weeks and through the winter. And is it notably or substantially above, say, 2018 or 2015 or other kind of tough seasons?
Well, 2017/18 was a particularly bad flu season year where we had people literally in corridors in hospitals. The hospitals were overrun, as far as I remember, 25,000 admissions into A&E in the space of 3 months. A lot of those people would have been sent home with a, you know, packet of paracetamol. But in saying that, many of those, probably a few thousand, would have been admitted to hospital, and many would have had serious conditions, including pneumonia at the end of it, and possibly died.
Yeah, absolutely. In the UK, the 17-18 was very severe. Many hospitals were overrun. It was in the media. No one really noticed too much, it appears. But in January, in the Mirror, I have the article, there were 20,000 excess deaths over December. So doctors have assured me as well, yeah, it was a really tough period. But again, it didn't have the COVID kind of scenario. So it was probably more accepted as what happens every few years.
Okay, well, you started off kind of, you know, researching the root causes of modern chronic diseases. And this, of course, you know, came along, it hit our shores in and around the end of January, February, although some people believe maybe earlier, could have been November, December, we just didn't recognise it at the time. What were your thoughts? Were you like everybody else at first when the WHO said, listen, there's a 5% mortality, we're all going to die? I mean, was there a fear just like everybody else when you heard about this?
Well, yeah, okay, I can answer that truthfully. So I had no fear, and it's not because I'm particularly brave, but I had seen the Chinese data, and I took a bit of an interest, and I realized that the curve appeared to be following a kind of a classic influenza-type illness, a seasonal-type curve, up sharply and then tailing off. And I'd seen the Diamond Princess cruise ship data, which had elderly people. And it was quite clear from that data in a petri dish environment that the damage would be somewhat limited and very, very highly targeted towards aged or immunocompromised. Now, all deaths are important, of course. I don't mean to understate it. But I could see that the impact would be probably like a bad flu year. And therefore, I wasn't particularly worried. Not that I didn't have empathy for people affected, but I just said, okay, a bad flu year is probably what it'll look like. And that's essentially what it did look like.
But you don't get involved, I suppose, from an emotional or a medical point of view. What your speciality is watching these curves, looking at the numbers, trying to solve the problem and trying to figure out how we can get through this in a more logical fashion. Do you believe that the government made the right decision back in March when we didn't have very much data apart from China and some of the videos that were going around? I got a few of them on WhatsApp myself in and around the start of March or end of February of people literally dead on streets. Now, we know that clearly didn't happen. I don't know what, though, whether they were faked or whatever, because in Ireland, I haven't seen people dying on streets or in the UK for that matter, where it's been particularly bad. But I mean, when you were looking at this data at the start, like everybody else, were you kind of glad the government stepped in and said, okay, until we know what's going on, let's just close everything?
Yeah, well, actually, back then, by having seen the data, I kind of already knew that a lockdown wouldn't really do a whole lot for an influenza-type viral transmission illness. And I figured as well, it's probably come into Europe around November, December, and there'd be a lot of dormancy. So sure enough, we had several months where not much happened, and then we got the inevitable sudden rise of the seasonal trigger. So I figured it wouldn't do much, but I also acknowledged the precautionary principle. Everyone was scared. We had the weird stuff coming out of China, like you mentioned. And I said, look, fair enough, couple of weeks, flatten the curve. It's not really going to flatten the curve, but it doesn't really matter. It's a few weeks, and we'd be taking action, and it's probably the right thing to do in principle. Now, the problem was after a few weeks when the curve turned over inevitably and the ICUs began to, you know, come not under pressure and everything began to relax down in the classic curve, they didn't really want to stop the lockdown type measures. And that's when I became more interested and got more involved.
And when you say they didn't want to stop, I mean, the government will pat themselves on the back, as Leo did and everybody when he handed over, I suppose, the gauntlet to Micheál Martin, and patted themselves on the back saying, the lockdown worked. Well done, everybody. We're in this together, which was the kind of line. So you don't believe, do you believe without the lockdown, we would have seen exactly more or less the same set of curve, or would we have lost a few more people? Because surely the whole idea of lockdown is to reduce the amount of contacts that people have. And surely with a virus, which has an R naught of maybe two or so, that the more people are together, the quicker it'll spread, which gives us less chance to deal with it. Surely that would be the logic, wouldn't it?
It would be somewhat intuitive, but then again, the science is more complex than that. So with a high R up to 2.8, as was clearly called out in February, when it comes into Europe in November, and we had the first UK death recently verified, a man in December, so it's coming in November, so we had four unfettered months with this high R virus. So just think about that a little before anything really happened.
I suppose people blame the main, I suppose, trigger for this was kind of put on the Italians coming over that weekend, Cheltenham. There was a couple of trigger moments that people kind of pin it back to and say that's when it kind of kicked off. And then there was a bit of a lag for 3 weeks and then we saw the increase in cases. You wouldn't go along with that, no?
Well, in the US, it's been verified January at least was the first case. And in the UK, it would have come in November because we had a man die in December. So the reality is it came in earlier and there was no restraints, no restrictions, no one even knew about it. So you can point to first cases and you can point to events, but that's associational data. So that's associating something with something that occurs. It seems intuitive. Humans have been doing that for millions of years.
But we probably wrote off many deaths in January and February as being part of influenza or pneumonia because we didn't really think that people had COVID-19 yet in Ireland.
I think probably quite a lot of that. I've been assured by a doctor friend, an Irish doctor, that his parents definitely died of it in January. Mm-hmm. And based on the symptoms and all, he didn't know it at the time, but he saw them as unique. So that's anecdotal, so I'd be careful saying that. I have a few more of those from nurses.
Well, I know Dr. Martin Freely pointed to a case, I think in Cork, he was talking about a man. I think he was referring to December, I think.
Oh, right, okay, very good. Yeah, that's a documented case. So essentially it goes back to the point. And in Brazil we see as well in the human sewage, same as Europe, SARS-CoV-2, this virus, was present in human sewage. We were pooing it out in November. And Brazil, however, because of the seasonal triggering I mentioned, Brazil actually saw nothing up until around April, May, June, July. They had the surge in mortality. So there's seasonal triggering here, but the virus comes in quite a lot earlier, depending on the area of the world. the triggering is different.
So then where are we now, Ivor? So you talk about this classic curve, and I've seen these curves in every single country that kind of rises up, falls back down, and then elevates slightly again. So you got this classic curve everywhere, including places like Sweden, who didn't have a very strict lockdown. It's a bit of a myth to say they didn't have a lockdown, but they just didn't have a very strict one. They didn't wear the masks, they didn't close their schools, people went to work and went on public transport, etc., etc. So, and they didn't close their bars. But they did ask people to social distance. They did stop all large events, concerts and gigs and football matches and all that. So they did do something about it. So we've still seen the same curve more or less everywhere, no matter what any country did. So where are we now? The curve, according to the government and NPHET, is rising again, and we're seeing an increase in cases. Is that directly related to the fact that they're doing more testing, or is there genuinely more people getting it, in your opinion?
Okay, so there's quite a bit to unpack there. Briefly, we'll dwell on Sweden. So Sweden, actually, I have a CNN report where they visited Stockholm on May the 6th, and I also interviewed yesterday an ER doctor in Sweden, and it all checks out. So basically, they showed people living almost as normal in Stockholm on May the 6th, and that was kind of in the middle of their epidemic. So yes, they did follow. Basically, they followed the rules for epidemics, pandemics that were generated over many decades, right up to the end of 2019. They followed the original science, and we are the exception. We leverage science, apparently, from China, lockdown science, but that was new.
Well, but the UK are doing the same as we're doing at the moment, aren't they?
We is a very broad we. Yeah, I mean, we all over the place, and encouraged by WHO, rightly or wrongly. We did something new and interesting. But we now have 5 published papers from all around the world that actually analyzed the data on lockdown efficacy and impact. And it wasn't based on modeling like Neil Ferguson's modeling that was out by a factor of 12. That's established. It's actually...
Sam McConkie said the same thing here at the start of this. He described this, it could be similar to an Irish civil war, I think was that, I'm paraphrasing. And he also said there would be possibly up to 120,000 people would die.
Well, yeah, they quoted 28,000 to 35,000 months ago, and I did some videos on that and showed how Sweden, with the minimal distancing and washing hands, etc., no masks, they basically saw around 12 times lower than the modeling for Sweden with minimal measures. So it's out by a factor of 10, and I think that's actually a scientific fact now. It's not really a conjecture.
It is fair to say that Sweden now are looking at probably the lowest cases in Europe, the lowest hospitalizations and ICU. But at the start, or going back to May or April, they were criticized because in comparison, in the deaths per million, when we look back at Sweden, they would have had a higher rate deaths per million. Now, I do know there's different factors there, like, you know, the age demographic of the country, too, is obviously a factor. But, I mean, they did have a higher death rate at the start.
They did indeed, but notably, there's a 3.5-week lag approximately between when you put in measures and when you actually can see a result in the death figures. And Sweden was rising in death well within that 3.5 weeks. So to simplify for the audience, they were already different than the Nordics before any of their choice of measures could have kicked in markedly. So the fact is, Sweden, there's a paper out now, 16 reasons why Sweden was higher than the Nordics. And it goes through 16 reasons, and lockdown is the least of it. So Sweden had 580 deaths per million, approximately. Ireland had around 360. If you account for care home and demographics and other vectors, they're similar to Ireland, rough and tough, and are lower than the UK and around 7 or 8 other countries. So Sweden
if that's the case, and I'm not disagreeing with you, I mean, a lot of countries now are looking at Sweden saying, well, maybe they didn't get it wrong, they're embarrassing the rest of Europe. But if that's the case, then why is Boris Johnson, why is Micheál Martin or Stephen Donnelly, whoever happens to be in charge of health in this country at the moment, I really don't know anymore, even Leo Varadkar's thrown his pennies worth in today. I mean, why are we not looking at Sweden or looking at other countries? If you're saying there's evidence there to suggest that lockdowns don't work, why are we still doing it?
Well, because one thing is the embarrassment and political embarrassment and a million other things are beyond colossal now. Because we've destroyed economies, we've basically taken away human rights, we've isolated the poor aged, you know, many of them would much prefer to be able to hug and meet their people rather than have a little bit of extra existence, if indeed the lockdown is affording that. So I could go on and on. Cancer diagnoses missed, depression, elevation of suicides is inevitable. So the collateral damage, the cost and the cost benefit of lockdowns is enormously out of kilter. So the very concept that it was a mistake, I mean, no politician in the world is going to even face that at a subconscious level.
Okay, because you think that would mean defeat for them. But are we saying that then politicians don't have the best interests of their citizens at heart? Because realistically, politicians will be well aware of the damage they're doing to the economy, to businesses, to people's lives, the quality of people's lives, and the future, I mean, when it comes to non-COVID-related illnesses, which are not being early diagnosed. So surely they would see the unquantifiable damage that they're doing for the next 2 years. Certainly.
Yeah, well, they believe in their heads that it's justified. And now they're not analysing it. There's no proper analysis of the cost of this at all, except for one paper from England, which is scary in its own right. So no one's actually looking at it. So you can ask, well, why are they not? And you can ask, why would they not worry about it? And I guess many of them, I suppose, are caught up in their own hysteria. And because they scaremongered the populations in the countries originally, the populations now have been severely scaremongered, and they're actually demanding of the politicians more lockdowns. You know, the teachers were asking for no school openings. So they've created a kind of a monster of fear, and I guess fear got the best of them. They lost the run of themselves.
But when you say scaremongered, are people not genuinely, I mean, are people not genuinely scared by the information that they're receiving and the information that they're seeing? Or, you know, okay, you know, I know we can write off some of the debts, and I don't mean that any insensitive way to people who have very critical underlying conditions. But many people, you will agree, have died directly of COVID-19.
Absolutely. So the figures, well, let's dwell there for a moment. So the figures for Ireland, and this may surprise people, shall we say, maybe not shock them, but surprise them. So around 1,800 died, tragically, with SARS-CoV-2, and many would have been mostly driven by COVID. Absolutely. The new figures are maybe 1,100 excess deaths, and we saw Leo Varadkar a couple of months ago retweeting that. And then there's other lower figures from some sources. And then there's the figure of 100 with no comorbidities. But we'll put that one aside.
Well, I think it's fair to put it aside, because if I had diabetes, I would have a comorbidity or an underlying condition. And if I died of COVID, I could have another 30 years left of my life.
Exactly, yeah. Because we all have a right to life, and just because we have a condition, exactly. I mentioned it for the record, but put it aside. So let's say 1,800, the high figure. Many people may not be aware that 1,700 approximately of it, these 1,800, and it was an RTE on the May 28th, I saved the webpage from the HSE, 1,700 or around 95% were never given an intensive care unit to try to save them. Now, people would say, hold on, that's impossible. But no, it's on RTE. So why would that be? And the answer quite simply is that 1,700 out of the 1,800 deaths were so aged or comorbid or stage 4 cancer, perhaps, with organ failure.
It would have been unethical to bring them to a hospital.
Yeah. Yes. Now, again, I stress, because you get the people who screech, I stress all life is important. My own mother is 80 coming into this, right? I have a lot of relations who are elderly and with diabetes. But let's stick to facts and proper management of a situation. 1,700 were not afforded ICU. That is the picture of Ireland's epidemic. And I know that most people in Ireland I spoke to had a perception that people were dying all over the place, that this was terrible. And in the Euromomo countries, 360 million people, let's stick to facts. This year, there's 185,000 excess deaths in the respiratory season. And 2018 was 140,000. So we're around 30 to 35% worse than 2018 in terms of excess mortality.
Okay, and for people who don't understand, that's the amount of people who died this year versus last year versus the year before. I'm measuring the amount of people that overall that died. Because on average, what is it, 79 people die every single day in this country, in and around that kind of figure, die every day in this country.
That's another beautiful opening, because, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, we've risen, we're rising. Well, of course we're rising. We're heading into the season where respiratory will rise. But just to give an example, on August 24th in Ireland, right, there were 0.1 or one-tenth of a person per million people died per day with SARS-CoV-2, one in 10 million people. on August 24th. And now we're up to 0.3 of a person in a million people, or 3 in 10 million, dying on September 27th. So people need to realize the figures, all life is important, but the figures for mortality from this are actually vanishingly small. And they will rise coming into the winter, as is, and I hate to use the word normal, but it is sadly normal. Blame the virus. You can't blame anything else.
Well, many viruses, many different types of viruses, yeah, of course, which are seasonal. But I mean, and everybody is listening to what you're saying, Ivor, and I, you know, I've watched some of your videos and I've looked at some of your facts and figures that you have up on Twitter, and I've read some information myself, and I'm not disagreeing with anything that you've probably said tonight, because everything you've said is quite factual. It's obviously the whatever take you want to have on this. But again, it comes back to that if we're seeing, you know, the cases going up, and now we'll argue, or we'll talk about, when I say we'll argue, we'll talk about PCR testing in a second and the amount of tests we're actually doing at the moment, which is an incredible amount of tests, 93,000, I think, in a 7-day period, record numbers. But if the cases are rising and more people, even if we factor in, you know, false positives, et cetera, more people are having SARS-CoV-2, why is the death rate not rising at the same rate?
Okay, great question. So I sent out a tweet and I repeatedly resend it to people who asked the question. So there's a few primary reasons and then there'll be many secondary ones. But one of the first primary reasons is the passing of the susceptible. So these viruses tend to cause severe sequelae or outcomes in the aged and people with compromised immune systems. And we know that since February. So the susceptible have largely passed in many instances. So that's going to take away the death impact.
But we will, and I heard this mentioned, I'm not too sure who said it in the White House more recently in relation to people who are susceptible, and that's why the death rate has gone down, because those who had, I suppose, had already got into are already gone or they've passed away. But every year we have more susceptible people. So more people become susceptible, don't they?
Exactly, and that's a crucial point too, and I'm glad you said it, because over the 6 or 8 months, these viruses come in, they cause an impact, and in the following winter, when I'll actually go through the three top reasons. So the first one was the passing susceptible. The second one is that you develop community immunity. So many of us have some immunity from prior coronaviruses in various mechanisms, but we develop more, obviously, when the least immune are exposed. And the third thing is seasonal difference. The suppression of the human immune system in winter causes more exposure. So they're the three main reasons, and there's a bunch of others.
Why does our immune system, I mean, we always hear about seasonal viruses, and, you know, is it to do with temperature? I mean, what is the reason why, you know, our immune system seems more susceptible, you know, kind of from October right through to February? What is that reason?
Well, the primary hypothetical reason, because no one has proven it conclusively, but there's some great papers on this, is that the lowering of the ultraviolet flux causes a lowering of vitamin D and other photoproducts in our bodies, and we know we get higher heart attacks, we know we get obviously massively higher influenza in the summer and the early spring, and it would relate to a lowering of the immune function, and one of the mechanisms is vitamin D, levels in the blood and UV, but also there's temperature and humidity, which can favor the virome.
Some people had put it down to temperature. Initially at the start, they thought, for example, that COVID-19 wouldn't survive over 25 or 26 degrees. And then all of a sudden we were seeing it spreading across places like Florida and Iran and places like that where it would be quite warm. Now, the argument was that it was probably been spread in air-conditioned buildings and not out in the open, because both ultraviolet light has been proved to obviously eradicate the virus, and also high temperatures. So, you know, are we saying that during the summer season, which we've just had, and by the way, we had good weather during the lockdown and we had a lot of deaths, so that probably doesn't tie in too well with that. But are we saying that when the weather gets duller, darker and colder, that we're going to see COVID-19, I suppose, spread quicker? Is that going to be the case?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of schools of thought. You can say spread or you can say resurgence of the virus. Because there is a certain amount of dormancy involved too, but we won't get caught in that. But yes, in the winter, this is normal. We've seen the pattern forever. And coronaviruses are very similar to flu. They're just a little later. They tend to be later towards the spring in their surge. But this has been documented and studied forever. And the prior two coronaviruses, the SARS-1 and that, they demonstrated an initial curve, like we said, and then they didn't really have a second wave for the three reasons I said. Now, nothing is impossible in science. A totally bizarre thing could happen, and SARS-CoV-2 could somehow become dominant this winter in
Europe.
Could it mutate? Not so much. So it's generally accepted influenzas can mutate in a major way, and the 1918 flu may have been an example of that. But the coronavirus family is very stable. And there will be mutations occasionally, like this one, but to do a rapid mutation into a very virulent form would be highly unusual. So, but nothing's impossible.
Okay, so where are we at now when it comes to a plan in your mind? Let me put you in a position, Ivor. You're in charge of the country. It's your job to make the next decision. And it's a difficult decision for anybody in government to make because you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. So what would you do tomorrow if you were in charge?
Okay, well, I'll say first that I've obviously linked in and interviewed a lot of professors in many fields on this, so it's not just my opinion, besides my own research. I would say I would do exactly what Sweden did and are doing, pretty much. And that would be perfect, in my mind, crisis management for an optimum outcome for all of society, health and well-being.
So what you're talking about is a reasonably slow herd immunity.
Yeah, and to be honest, herd immunity is an inevitability.
I know it's almost a dirty word in the media at the moment, but I know it shouldn't be a dirty word. It's probably the one thing that we have going for us as human beings.
Yeah, exactly. And Professor Beda Stadley, who's the Fauci of Switzerland, I interviewed, and I went over to Switzerland.
We had him on the show recently.
Oh yes, you did. Yeah. So he basically said it all. He essentially said 80% of people, largely with a new coronavirus, are de facto immune. Now, it doesn't mean they're immune. It means that they'll really experience no particular impact and they won't transmit much because they've got mucosal or T-cell or many types of immunity that recognize proteins from prior coronaviruses. And this is just a fundamental scientific fact.
So this is why when COVID-19 gets into a nursing home and there's 30 residents, only 15 or so actually get it. And why don't the rest get it? Because they probably have some sort of T-cell immunity.
Yes, or even better, all of the tracking of symptomatic people, the index cases, the studies, generally speaking, 80%+ of people who mix with those people indoors don't get it, right? So that kind of illustrates that it's not that we're all... Ferguson assumed we were all naive, we had no immunity. That's a preposterous suggestion in his
projection. I think most experts, with the exception of a few, have more or less said at this stage there is a percentage and probably a large percent of the population who will never get it. And even if they do, it'll be asymptomatic. So let's run with this kind of slow herd immunity that you're talking about. So we're not going to have football games or you're not going to have large gatherings. Would you restrict them to, say, 400 or 500 people outdoors, maybe 100 people indoors? Or what way would you do that?
Well, yeah, okay. So I'll be a bit controversial here and I'll say when the seasonal curve, the Gompertz curve, was fulfilled around May, we could have actually opened up almost completely. Now, I'm not saying I would definitely do that because there's a precautionary principle and you'd hedge. But we could have
And what about the hospitals? Because, look, whether it's COVID-19, whether it's influenza, no matter what the virus is, you know that our health service was on its knees before COVID-19 came along. We were already under a huge amount of pressure. This has actually shown up the health service to be as bad as it actually was, and the government needed to step in and do something about it anyway. So maybe this is a good thing in some sense. That's probably the only good thing to come out of it. But, I mean, if you had have opened up, say, back in end of June, and just opened up everything and said, right, go off and play your GAA and have your gigs in the Point Depot and do whatever you want. And all of a sudden you had thousands of people getting it to a herd immunity. In some sense, that's a good thing because they're not going to hopefully get it again. But there are going to be casualties to that.
Well, that is very debatable. So whether the strategy would have been to protect the over 65s, particularly with comorbidities or illnesses known to be associated with suppressed immune function, and you would have done that while letting the rest of society run largely free. And you might have hedged a bit to prevent major events, but you would have certainly opened up, and you most certainly would not have, in the middle of the summer, with all impacts on the floor, and we know coronaviruses float around in the summer with almost no impact, we know that from prior studies, you would never have brought in mandatory masks with threat of prison and fines.
So now, do you don't agree with the masks, but is it for I suppose liberty reasons and taking away your rights to make a decision, or is it that you don't believe the evidence is there? Because they claim, although there's been many studies that say there's no evidence to suggest that masks are of any benefit whatsoever, but there is claims now that there's observational studies, I haven't seen any of them, there's observational studies that masks do actually help to stop the virus.
Yeah, well, we have 44 decades of science that say no significant useful impact, and we have 4 weeks of studies rapidly thrown out with associational evidence, which is the lowest possible form of evidence, that suddenly said they did in June. I'd put 4 decades ahead of 4 weeks. So that's just the way I am. So my motivation is truth and science. And also, of course, the future health of our society.
Was it not good advice to tell people who particularly would be symptomatic, you know, sitting on a bus, the last thing you need is somebody who may be symptomatic, sitting on a bus coughing their brains out, to tell them to wear a mask?
Absolutely, symptomatic, but we didn't. We said everyone. And the other thing is, independent of the science on whether masks are effective in viral transmission, and it's completely hazy and very weak, Professor Carl Hennigan of Oxford Centre of Evidence-Based Medicine came to the Irish Oireachtas, and he said, if you want to put in masks, you can do it, but you cannot claim it's evidence-based. And he was very, very clear on that, and he's correct. So,
there are people who will argue there's a correlation with the fact that the case numbers have gone up over the last 3 weeks and 4 weeks, and we've made masks mandatory over the last 4 weeks, which means it probably didn't help too much but maybe it did.
There would, but if you look all across Europe, mandatory mask orders that came in and were immediately complied with, they had zero effect on the R curve and zero effect on any real-world outcome across all the countries. That's a fact that you can't get around.
Okay, so if you're in charge tomorrow, you would remove that mandatory. If people want to wear masks, yeah, absolutely, you're quite happy to.
Oh, yeah. But the other thing, Niall, is, and I have to stress it, I pushed masks in March, end of March and April. And the reason I did is it made much more sense than lockdowns. And I said, why don't we protect the elderly, protect the ill, and use masks? And I was all for it. But the problem is masks in the middle of a summer. We've had 4 months now with vanishingly small impact, exactly as predicted by the science. And we brought in masks in the middle of the summer. Now, anti-science is offensive to me. Sorry, it's just one of the things that gets me going. And independent of libertarianism or anything, anti-science offends me. And bringing in masks in the middle of a summer, right, for an severe influenza type illness that's seasonal, dramatically clear in the data, and you bring in masks in the middle of the summer when nothing's happening, when would you ever take them out if you bring them in when they're completely pointless? And this is what really hit me in June, July. I said, what are they doing?
I mean, was it surprising to you that when you heard Neffis and Luke O'Neill and Professor Fauci in America and everybody turning around at the time that you were probably saying stick them on you earlier in the year, and they were saying absolutely not, they will actually do more damage. Luke O'Neill's very words were, if you want to wear a mask and there's nothing wrong with you, you've been watching too many horror movies. And Fauci said something similar, something along the same lines, that people were paranoid if they wanted to wear masks. And within 2 or 3 months, they had all changed their mind, including Neffet. And I heard Neffet on the radio at the time saying they didn't approve of wearing masks, but all of a sudden changed their mind again. Did that turnaround shock you?
It shocked me what they did, because it was anti-scientific. And it's always dangerous in a society when they reject science and bring in draconian measures that have no real basis in science. So I was shocked. And yes, I'd seen them go against masks and was surprised in March, because it was a measure that was relatively easy, might help a little with transmission, and we were going to head into a big viral curve. So why not do it?
Would you not adopt, when I asked you about, you know, running the country, and you said, well, if it was the end of June, you probably would have said, look, go back to normal, with the exception of maybe the very large gatherings. I mean, I know Raj Vopal in Edinburgh had suggested that there was 137 million 0 to 19-year-olds in the 8 major European countries in America, and only 61 had died. So the logical thing to do, if you wanted to create a herd immunity, would be to encourage young people to be together, obviously whilst protecting those in the vulnerable groups. Would that not be a better suggestion, if you were going to go down that herd immunity route?
Well, if you were a scientific thinker, it would be, but we seem to have a lack of those. So, I mean, what can I say?
But I mean, see, this is what frustrates me. I'm talking to you and you're giving me facts and figures and your interpretation, of course, of those facts and figures. Mm-hmm. You know, I could have somebody on tomorrow who might be from Neffet and they will give me facts and figures, maybe similar to yours, and they'll have a different interpretation of those facts and figures. And yes, we're all going for this one interpretation. I'm listening to other people, other great scientists, other great immunologists and virologists and people who know what they're talking about, people like yourself who, you know, have spent years in solving problems and studying modern chronic diseases. And yet nobody is listening. Everybody is like putting their fingers in their ears and going, la, 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 we're doing it our way. Why? I don't believe in all the kind of, you know, the 5G stuff and waving the flags on a Sunday afternoon and the Patriots and all this. That stuff there is just irrelevant to me because all that blend goes into kind of runs into conspiracy theorism. But what I do believe is I can't understand. I'm coming back to it. I know I mentioned at the start what the end game is. I know you're saying maybe they're afraid to stop because they'll have to admit that they were wrong. But surely they're watching these governments, be it Ireland, England, France, Spain. I mean, they're calling for a lockdown in Madrid. There was one in Liverpool, a lockdown in Liverpool there today as well. Surely they're watching their own economies go down the toilet and their own citizens suffer badly. I just don't see the end game for them. And I don't see this collusion, this kind of new world order that people keep wandering on about online as well. So, I mean, I just don't think it's that simple to write it off as some sort of collusion or new world order or great reset or whatever it happens to be. I mean, do you have a theory on it, Ivor?
Oh, a lot to unpack there again. Well, 5G, I wouldn't wipe my arse with, and that's a personal opinion. I just ignore everything that comes into my inbox on that because of my engineering background. And it could be wrong or it could be right. Who cares? Not interested. In terms of, you know, the dynamics of this, I do root cause diagrams for everything, and it's not just technical stuff. You can do it for politics. You can do it for psychology. What are the root causes driving? Now, we talked about big ones. I mean, the fear of being wrong, the fear of being caught out if deaths do rise, and all of that is driving all of these people. In a sense, you could almost say in the Irish phrase, they've lost the run of themselves. And I think in the face of the data, that's what's happened. However, you can't ignore, you know, conspiracy theories are when you say you have secret knowledge of some cabal somewhere planning something. And obviously, I don't touch that with a barge pole. However, it's not a conspiracy theory if they actually tell you what they're doing. So I think that's a great phrase. So I would just say there are influences in the world and they're open and they're completely transparent. No one's looking. The WHO have been very clear in what they want to drive, for better or for worse, and that is mass influencing all the governments. The World Economic Forum.
Well, that is their job. They're funded by countries all over the world to make those decisions on behalf. I mean, obviously, America have their own with the CDC and we have the European Centre for Disease Control. But the WHO, with the exception of America, because they're not buying into it anymore, are, I suppose, essentially in charge when we get to a pandemic stage.
Well, yes and no. They're not a democratically elected organisation as such. And they are an advisor, but they've become almost like the orchestra lead with full powers. But that kind of just happened in the last 6 or 8 months. So you could argue about that. But anyway, they've made their position clear. And the World Economic Forum, you know, is open and it sees coronavirus as a massive opportunity. And they've published on this on their website, very powerful international organization. And they have goals and strategies, you know, for shaping a new world. And they've been very public. They see this as an opportunity. So there are many organizations that have goals, and they may be good goals, but their goals are certainly leveraging coronavirus and an interest in having it be a very big thing. So let's just say there's no conspiracy. There's simply very large international organizations that see this as an opportunity. And I stress, it could be a good opportunity. Maybe their goals and strategies are good for the world. It's not evil. It's just that there are a lot of people where this is an opportunity. And
we see the tech companies, of course, benefit from COVID-19, particularly Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, all these other companies have benefited greatly. Amazon in particular, a 300% rise in turnover over the last 7 months. But in saying that, getting back to, I suppose, COVID-19 here in Ireland, we're hearing the word new normal all the time, you know, the way we behave, the way we distance, the way we interact as human beings. And there has been great studies in the last 30 years on humans and primates and how, you know, social isolation or isolating from other human beings can be physically damaging as well as the mental health damage that it's causing to the country. But do you believe it, we will ever get back to the old normal? Because I'm listening to some of these experts or so-called experts, which are wheeled out on television and radio in this country, telling us that this could be around till we get a vaccine, which could be 5 years, could be 10 years, could be next year. We don't know. And we need some sort of 6 or 7 year plan. Am I going to be sitting here for 6 or 7 years, not going away on holidays, having to wear a mask in a shop, not being able to meet me mates or have them over to the house? Do you see that new normal lasting that long? And will we ever get back to the old normal?
Well, I would say, firstly, I got to call out that the first thing that really triggered my concern on this whole issue was actually in March, before we experienced the inevitable rise in mortality from this virus, because I began to see the new normal phrase coming out everywhere as a certainty before we were even hit. And I said, hold on a minute. How do they know there'll never be the old normal, given the data from China and from the Diamond Princess? How can they say there'll never be an old normal when quite clearly it's going to be a kind of a very bad flu equivalent? How on earth can they state there'll never be an old normal? And I wondered, how can they do that? And the thing is, you're right, it's been parroted ever since. But around June in Europe, it should have gone back largely to the old normal, except for what is part of the old normal are the epidemic guidelines of hygiene, washing hands, staying at home if you're sick, just like Sweden, and keeping distance when you're in an epidemic scenario. That's part of the old normal. I have no problem with that. We would not be discussing this if they followed the traditional guidelines for epidemics. We're only discussing it because the new normal has been forced in, and it doesn't make sense on most of the science. That's why we're here.
Okay, two more questions for you just before you go. One in relation to the long-term damage. There's been a lot of stories in the paper about people who have long-term damage after having COVID-19 or having symptoms of COVID-19 and ending up in a hospital where they can't get themselves back to normal. They're tired for months and months and months. I know this can happen with pneumonia as well and influenza too. But, I mean, are you denying that those people are telling the truth? Or, I mean, we've had a lot of healthcare workers saying they can't get back to work again, they're not able to, and that they have long-term, you know, their tiredness and all sorts of lung scarring and all sorts of different things.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not denying it because I haven't spoken on it, but here we go. Will I deny it? So the reality is that the sequelae of influenzas and shingles and many other viral illnesses, sequelae meaning long-term kind of effects beyond recovering from the base disease, are not uncommon at all. Has COVID got a demonstrative and exceptional degree of that? Well, I'd simply say I'm waiting and watching because we've been going through this for 8 months now, millions of people. There's 40,000 published scientific and medical papers on COVID. I know it's hard to believe, but there are on every facet and aspect. And I've read quite a few of them. But there is no convincing paper yet in all that time on longer-term impacts. Now,
you mean again versus any other virus?
Versus any other virus or even in general. So if there's no published papers, when this thing is getting published on like nothing before in human history, I would wonder why there's no publications.
And finally, just before you go, Ivor, the media. They've had a huge. The media have played a massive role in this right through from February. As we do here, we struggle sometimes to talk about anything else because people want to talk about it. You walk down the street, it's the first thing people say to you. It's a nice day today. It's that COVID is a terrible old thing, isn't it? So how do you think the media have behaved in general? Don't be afraid to insult me, by the way. I'm okay with that.
No, in fairness, you've done pretty well, Don. Looking at your feed, but shockingly, disgracefully, abominably, I mean, there are not enough kind of words to describe it. I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime. And
when you say that, what, they're one-sided or they're scaremongering, fear factor?
Unbelievable. So they take every bit of bad news, I've observed, and run with it gushingly, breathlessly. And any good news like T-cell immunity or community immunity or comparisons with prior years, looking at full respiratory seasons, anything that puts this in perspective has been put to the last page. And that's been consistent, except the Telegraph has been reasonably good. The Spectator has Professor John Leon and others. There's pockets of real journalism, little pockets like islands during this whole thing. And I'd say to the people listening, ask yourself the question, on every major issue that's ever happened, you have debate. Why was it that there was no debate on national broadcasters or in general in the media? No debate on this. And what's more...
But it seems that anybody who steps outside the box or tries to suggest that, you know, this... We'll take Dr. Martin Freely, for example, who's been who's a very credible man, a cardiovascular surgeon, as far as I know, as also clinical director of the Midlands Hospital. He had an opinion. Whether we agree with his opinion or not, the old days we would debate things and we would talk about it. But now it seems to be, I'm sorry, but your position is untenable, you better go.
Exactly. And when you have a society that's a free, democratic, Western society, and for some reason, for a single issue, debate is essentially outlawed, and even top epidemiologists and professors in various fields are taken off YouTube back in March and April. It's not so bad now, thankfully. You've got to ask yourself the question, there's no conspiracy theory. You've got to ask the three-letter question, why? Why no debate? Why no discussion? And it's an important question for all.
And why do you think, just finally, why do you think that the media, is it because bad news sells?
It is a combination, a conflux of factors. Bad news sells. The media are under pressure for many, many years now. And someone told me in the media a simple thing. He said, a journalist who comes out with the latest scare story, no research needed because it fits the narrative, so you don't need to cover your ass, and you can bang it out, and it's going to be lapped up. If you want to do a real journalism article questioning the narrative, you got to do a lot of work, a lot of data, a lot of interviews. You got to make sure you're well covered, a lot of work. So there's an automatic kind of system in place.
I get you. Yeah. No, I know I've read some of the most ridiculous stories. Like, for example, you're more likely to get COVID if you're taller or you've longer hair, and ridiculous stories like that. And the media will just lap it all up. I think it's just anything at all. Once the word COVID is in it and it's bad news, sure, it's good for the papers. But listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us today or this evening, Ivor. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and very informative.
Anytime now.
You go. Ivor Cummins, biomedical engineer, degree in 1990, and has also spent 30 years in corporate and technical leadership, and has spent a lot of his life studying modern chronic diseases. The facts, the figures, his interpretation.
Real people, real opinions, real talk radio. The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Show. Classic hits.